field to semi-open sheet, something where the thing would be kind of constant over maybe a couple hundred megahertz of space, but apparently that's not the effect that I'm seeing here. Back to you.
Yeah, what's going on here, Joe, is that if you and I were designing that antenna for transmitting or receiving that television set of frequencies, we would be designing a flat antenna. It would be a pretty elaborate piece of electronics. What you're describing is an unintentional radiation of a lack of shielding of a system, and as such, it's certainly not going to be flat in its frequency response. It's not going to be flat in its angular response as to what directions it radiates in. If you did have a portable antenna, and probably you could do this with a simple rabbit ear or whip antenna on a battery-operated TV set, just by walking around that house, you're going to see that signal go up and down in amplitude as you change distance, as you change azimuth, as you change frequency. I can see how, as long as the vital frequencies for the FAA do not exceed the number of microvolts per meter that they must exceed, they must comply with in order to not interfere with television sets, with FAA aircraft, I can see how the cable TV company is going to give you a deaf ear unless that particular requirement is being violated. As such, without any help from the cable company, the next thing is the only way you're going to get a fix on assumptions taking place within that house when the job is you're going to have to carefully approach that neighbor. I know that's not easy. You've got a good working relationship with the neighbor and you've shared snow blowers in the wintertime and whatever, you stand a good chance of saying that, hey, I can make improvements to your television set. I can make it work better, and I will also become happier with my particular hobby of watching long-distance television from Connecticut. And we get a win-win situation here. It won't cost you anything. And with my portable TV set, I'll find out where the leakage is coming from. And it may be just simply tightening the connector on a particular power divider, and the problem will go away. If it happens to be a neighbor you don't have a good relationship with, now you're kind of stuck. They're not violating an FAA rule. They're not above the threshold of where the cable TV company will fix it, but they're above the threshold of annoyance for you. And without becoming friendly with the neighbor or forcing them to move and have a friendlier neighbor move in, wow. The next solution, Joe, is to put a great big shield around the house. I'm kidding, of course. Other than that, you might be a little bit stuck. And for a whole bunch of reasons, we amateurs must, in my opinion, bend over backwards to keep an extremely friendly relationship with your neighbors. Because from time to time, let me drop, we want to do things that are very different from the normal population. You want to convince that neighbor that, hey, you're the most compliant person in the world. If, for instance, they complain about television appearance, the first thing you do is ask them, what's your favorite television watching hour? Until we fix the problem, I will not use my ham radio equipment during that hour. That's the friendly way of doing it. And then slowly you develop their confidence and you find a solution to the problem. What many an amateur will do is to say, I've got a license issued by the Federal Communication Commission. I can radiate on any frequency anytime I want to. Your electronics is defective. It's your problem, and I'm not going to help you. You say words like that, you are in the first step of a range war, and war it will be. And I have seen a number of amateurs spend large numbers of dollars in legal fees fighting situations that get initiated like that. You have to accept the fact that you and your neighbor are living in each other's backyard, in each other's pocket. Use any words you want. Try to stay friendly. Even if the neighbor's request is thoroughly unreasonable, even if he's a raving maniac and he's accusing you of everything from rape and murder and who knows what else, don't get emotional with him. Try to keep it low-key and friendly. The time will come when you will need the friendship of that neighbor because of what you want to do. That's my recommendation. Not everyone will agree with that. Everyone will say, a number of amateurs will say, this is my right, and I'm exercising my right. I'll go easy with your right. Someday, a number of what you think are rights are privileges, not rights. For instance, the ability to drive an automobile is not a right. It's a privilege. That license you're issued is just proving that you have the competence to be allowed to use that privilege. So this is a philosophy I'm giving you. I know darn well that a lot of people will not accept it. Over to you, Joe. W2RYY, TQRIW.
want to comment on this particular subject. I happen to notice that this particular problem with my monitoring antenna, for example, which can pick up, you know, of course, the whole frequency band. I've looked at these video carriers or listened to them, and I've also watched occasionally the intensity instantly change from something like, say, an S5 to an S9 instantaneously. So I know it's some sort of bad connection somewhere. Whether it's coming from the or it's a bad connection up on the pole somewhere, that I don't know.
Yeah, but the transmitter has a low frequency. By way of a portable TV with a whip antenna or rabbit ears or whatever, and walking around the property at a time that doesn't scare them, don't do it at 3 o'clock in the morning when they're up late at night, so to speak, and there's somebody prowling in their backyard. But by one means or another, you will be able to pin down the exact source, particularly if you use directional antennas, but even without directional antennas, as long as you've got some kind of a signal transmitter. If you can monitor the automatic gain control voltage on that portable TV, battery-operated thing that you walk around with, it doesn't even have to be a portable TV. There's probably a way you can take your R7000 and run it on a 12-volt battery and walk around and look at signal strength. The nice thing about it is it's got a 20 dB attenuator and a beautiful signal strength meter on the front panel. I'll know that, let's see, does mine have a handle on the side? Yeah, it's got a handle on the side. It's made to be walked around with, a little on the heavy side. But by one means or another, you will be able to pin down the exact location of that radiation. And then after that, that'll tell you what's required for the next step. And hopefully there's a way you can come up with a good agreement with that neighbor, because I think the cable company is going to give you a deaf ear. I think the FAA and the FCC is going to give you a deaf ear. I think it's between you and the neighbor. That's what I see, Joe, and I hope it goes well. And it's going to take some time to find a solution to this one. Worst comes to worst, you're going to be jammed on watching certain weak signals that you'd like to watch for your television DXing hobby. And hopefully there's some other frequencies that don't get jammed by that darn cable system. Thank you for any final comments on this, Joe. And keep us informed as to how the progress on this one takes place. The B2RYY, our television expert, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Paul recognized, but Joe first. Go, Joe.
Another aspect is like this. If you're getting TV off the air in, say, a particular direction like New York, and you had this interference coming along, all right, if it's coming along the side of the antenna, it's probably not going to be too terribly bad as a problem. But if you had a leaky type of situation happen, and they're broadcasting analog channels on the same frequencies as the digital over-the-air broadcast being New York, I would, if you had a leakage pop out like this from time to time, it's maybe possibly intermittent or whatever the case may be, it may hamper your ability to actually watch TV. Now, I wonder what kind of stand the FCC would take if they knew something like that was actually happening. Yes, it doesn't interfere with the airplane, but, you know, if you had a leakage coming out of some of these TV frequencies, I'm sure it would give the over-the-air broadcast a good run for the money and maybe make the picture break up occasionally. What do you think?
You've got an interesting point there, Joe. Obviously, there is essentially a right, as I see it, as an American citizen, to be allowed to put a television aerial on the roof of your house if your local zoning board hasn't written some specific CC&R against it, or if it wasn't part of the deed of your house, so to speak. But in most cases, we have the right to put a television aerial on the roof of our house or inside the house, whatever, and watch over-the-air broadcast without interference from a cable TV system. So even if at worst you had to go and announce that in a newspaper, in a letter to the editor, that, hey, I'm unable to watch cable TV, I'm able to watch unable to watch over-the-air broadcast because brand name ABC of a cable TV company will not fix the leakage of their cable system. Well, if the leakage is really on the utility poles out in front of the house, they've got primary responsibility. If the leakage is taking place in the neighbor's house directly west of you toward the Empire State Building, would the cable TV company fix that for you? That's a tough one. They don't want to rile that particular neighbor that's giving them revenue every month, if you know what I mean. And I'd love to believe if you get to the right human being in the cable company and speak to him the right way, particularly if he's a ham radio operator, and many cable TV companies, somewhere buried in their staff of people, personnel, have a ham radio operator who good luck with it. Not an easy one, but you're a smart enough guy to find a way, I think, and let us know what you find. Paul wants to make some questions or comments on this. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul. And by the way, I've got a great thing to talk to you about Kepler. Kepler made its first discovery and an extremely good measurement of a exoplanet. In other words, they measured the atmosphere of a planet going around another sun 1,000 light years away from us. WS2N, K2RIW.
Hear that. I haven't gotten any Kepler updates in quite a while. Very good, Dick. The a good detector I use for cable leakage, for cable vision. You know, it's you take your HT. Most of my HTs go below 144 meg. So you tune to 143.750. 143.750. And that's the equivalent of channel 17 on Cablevision. You can go around to all kinds of different connectors everywhere, and if that's leaking, the audio for that station, channel 17 comes out on that frequency thing. So, you know, it's just that bad, and that works really good. Back to you.
Yep. 143.750, I think, is the audio of channel 17. 145.25, I think, is the video of channel 18. But 145.25, with a handy talkie, will often show you leakage. So, and the fact that there's leakage from the cable on that frequency suggests that there's going to be a number of other frequencies, like the ones Joe cares about, that are also leaking. So just for him to carry his handy talkie, his 2-meter handy talkie, around the neighbor's house, and hopefully eventually get permission to go in the house and find the exact leaking connection. That's a pretty much good one, Paul. Good suggestion. I think we've gone down the list of people. Oh, no. Let's see now. Rich wants to have a further discussion on this. Rich, actually, I'm terrible. Howie wants to discuss some analog and audio. One of the very best books that I've ever found on operational amplifiers is the Jung book, J-U-N-G, paperback. But the Jung book, most of the good information is combined into a larger compendium manual with a hell of a lot more information. If you go to the company called Analog Devices, go to their website, I presume it's still sold. A couple of years ago, I bought a beautiful book from them. It's a 8.5x11 format, 2-inch or 1.5-inch thick book. The darn thing must have 500 pages to it, must have about 20 separate chapters on various applications and spec sheets and everything else on analog devices, among other brand names, of operational amplifiers. But with operational amplifiers, you can make the input impedance to your audio amplifier, if that's what you want, or RF amplifier, anything from 1 ohm to many, many mega ohms. You can make that as an input impedance. You can make the output impedance anything from a fraction of an ohm to many mega ohms. You can make the gain anything between, I'll pick a number, minus 30 dB and plus 80 dB. This is for one particular op amp. Just set up the resistors around it the right way. The resistors determine the gain, the input impedance, and the output impedance. By selecting 3 or 4 resistors, you have the power to do all of that. And the actual device, the amplifier itself, might be $1. So, strongly recommending doing circuits with audio, any kind of analog circuitry, digital circuitry. Audio circuitry, IF circuitry, low frequency output, below a few hundred megacycles. If you haven't considered operational amplifiers, that's a great big stone unturned from my point of view. The schematic of a Wien bridge RC oscillator network looks so simple, but there's a lot of you're making the feedback frequency sensitive. You want the oscillators to oscillate on your chosen frequency. So that feedback network, you make it so that if I want the oscillators to run at 1 megacycle, you make sure that it's got the feedback network at 1 megacycle and no other frequency. And you make the loop gain greater than unity in order for it to start up and run. That's the good news. The bad news, every oscillator, by definition, to start up and running, must have a loop gain greater than unity. But because it's feeding its own signal back, it will immediately come to saturation, keep building up the signal gets stronger and stronger, and the oscillator will saturate, and eventually it makes a square wave. Because no matter what your amplifier phase is, it's got maximum voltage and minimum voltage, it can't go beyond. The art and the science of a nice wave of a cylinder is there has to be some kind of a automatic gain control circuitry. Recognizes the fact that you've reached the amplitude you care about, and now it gently turns down the gain so you don't exceed the amplitude capability of your amplifying device. In the case of the Hewlett-Packard audio oscillator, there was an incandescent light bulb in the cathode grounding circuit of the tube that was the original amplifying tube. And as the audio amplitude built up stronger, the AC voltage fed to that incandescent light bulb would start getting larger. The light bulb would light. The lighting of the light bulb means the filament got hotter. Every light bulb changes by more than 10 to 1 in resistance when the light bulb is cold versus hot. So the change in resistance of the incandescent filament of a light bulb that was in the cathode strip repeater.
Time out.
That became the sexy mechanism that would limit the gain so that it sat at exactly the power output or voltage output that you desired. That very simple light bulb circuit did that. Well, nowadays you don't want to put a light bulb in there because it's much too big. And you got to be kind of sophisticated as to what you put in there. Instead, that's not going to be clipping your sine waves, but yet controlling the gain. So you got to control the gain of every oscillator. Otherwise, it goes to infinity, if you know what I mean. And to do that well, that's the art. The science is to make sure that the feedback network is made out of resistors and capacitors, and it's got only one frequency it'll oscillate on. And as long as you don't change the resistor, and as long as you don't change the capacitor, then the frequency will not change. And you've got control, even though it's a very simple, inexpensive-looking circuit. Now, to get back to what I started to say earlier, for Paul, I subscribe to this service where NASA tells me, NASA Science Space, is it space.com? I think it's space.com. Space.com mails me every day or every other day some little piece of information. And the last piece of information I got a few days ago was what has Kepler discovered. Kepler was launched in April, I think it was, March, April, May, somewhere around the beginning of this year. The Kepler is the mission which is going to be looking at a dark area of space, studying a few thousand stars simultaneously, looking for very subtle changes in the brightness output of that star. The philosophy is that the vast majority of stars have a planetary system. A certain percentage of those stars, the planetary systems go around that star in a plane that includes the Earth. We're way off to one side, but in the plane, of their ecliptic. The Earth goes around the Sun and it sweeps out of lane, what we call the ecliptic. And if somebody is 1,000 light years away looking at our Sun, and he's looking at our Sun at the instant that our Earth sweeps in front of the Sun from his point of view, he's going to see a characteristic curve of decrease in apparent solar output. Okay? So they did that with a few thousand stars. That's what Kepler is doing. And one particular star has got this beautiful planet sweeping in front of it. Every 2.9 days, I think it is, it has to be a very fast planet in close. And because of the shape of the curve, not only are they tracing out this star with a planetary system that they didn't know about before, but now the resolution they're getting within Kepler is so much better than they've ever seen before. They're now seeing the characteristics of the rise and the fall of that occultation, and therefore looking at the spectral signature and figuring out how thick is the atmosphere and what is the atmosphere made of of this planet going around a star 1,000 light years away. Interesting stuff. Just a matter of time before we find some number of Earth-like planets in that particular direction where we're looking. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, I think it was a 3-year mission. They're at the beginning of the 3 years. And I think they said by the time, even a year goes by, they expect hundreds and hundreds of discoveries with the planets going in front of the star. So it's a good way of doing it. And what's interesting is, you know, they're all not going in our ecliptic. You know, there's plenty of planets that are going where this thing can't possibly do what it's doing when the stars are occulting the planets. Planets go in front of the stars. So you probably double the amount of planets. Let's say at the end of a year, they say there's 300 bound. You could probably easily say maybe there's 600 or 900 of them out there within that range. I think 1,000, so 1,000 light years. I didn't know they were going to go out that far, but I thought it was a little closer. But I guess it really doesn't matter. If they could see any kind of a dimming effect, just stare at the thing for days at a time and then come back, you know, a month later or a year later. That's what I
want
to see. Let me drop it.
Paul, actually, what Kepler is doing is looking at something like 10,000 stars simultaneously, continuously. And the circuitry of Kepler is looking at every one of the stars simultaneously. If any one of them begins any little blinking, that's the data that gets recorded. You don't want to do it in a cyclic manner when you miss things. And yet, they knew ahead of time. You're not going to catch all the planets. A lot of them don't line up with us. That's okay. If only 0.1%, if only 1 in 1,000 lines up with us, and you're looking at 10,000 of them, that's good enough. It's going to give you a lot of data. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, I understand that. But, you know, at the end of a year or two, we'll be able to say there's X amount of stars that this thing looked at, saw planets going around. I'm thinking a year. You want to find Earth-like planets that have the same, you know, one-year characteristics. You know, to really find a good planet with life, I think you're going to need a planet that goes around every year. You're going to need a Jupiter-sized planet on the outside of their solar system to clean up any incoming comets that might destroy the inner planets. You probably need a moon. I mean, without the moon, I don't think we would have the same type of life that we have today. You're going to need some type of moon to create different tides and to have the to have everything exactly the way we have it here. It's going to be a long shot. But first step would be to find, I think, a planetary system with a one-year period plus a Jupiter-sized planet on the outside. I hope they could find something like that. That would be a good starting point. Not the ones, you know, they've found plenty of Jupiter-sized planets, but, you know, 2-3 days going around. I don't think we need that. We need something on the outer planet. Back to you,
Dick. You're right. We're interested in planets that are in the Goldilocks zone. Not too close, not too far. You're probably right. To really have a good chance of forming life in a hurry, you'd like to have a moon. What the moon did for us is that there's a great big chunk of matter out there right now, 250,000 miles. It used to be a lot closer. But it is a stabilizing device, like a gyroscope, so that the wobble of the axis of our planet is a lot slower, a lot smaller, a lot more controlled. So the tilt of our planet is much more constant. And therefore we've got these very nice seasons of summer, winter, spring, and fall. That combined with water, and water in the universe which creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field creates a Van Allen belt. The Van Allen belt gives you protection from the solar wind. The solar wind doesn't get a chance to peel away our atmosphere. You hold on to it. You put that combination together, and the Stanley Miller experiment would lead you to believe that life will form every single time. All you got to do is wait. You take the concept of science that says that if you have enough matter interacting for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. Every reaction must take place. It's possible. And the Stanley Miller experiment, he just took a bunch of inert material, put it in a flask, passed a spark through it simulating lightning, and 13 of the 22 amino of the basic amino acids were formed in that simple experiment. In theory, if you waited long enough, life would crawl out of that flask I think it was done at the University of California, where Stanley Miller was working at the time. And so that's a very famous experiment that way back in the 50s. So there's lots of evidence that life will form, as long as you've got the right conditions. And it's nice to have an atmosphere, nice to have a body of water sloshing against the shore, and mixing all this soup together, and lightning, and weather, and whatever. It all happened.
Repeater, time out.
Things would all happen rather nicely. So it appears as though it's just a matter of time before we make contact with those other societies that essentially have to be there. I mean, there's good reason to believe now that at least 10%, if not a hell of a lot more, of all the stars out there contain planetary systems. I don't care if the good conditions of the Earth is one in a million, when you've got 100 billion stars per galaxy and 100 billion observable galaxies, that's 10 to the 22 individual stars. You cut it down by 1 billion to 1, 10 to the 6, subtract 10 to the 6, divide 10 to the 6 into 10 to the 22, and you're left with 10 to the 16? Yeah, 10 to the 16. So 10, 1 with 16 zeros after it is the number of stars out there that have predictable, the number of stars out there that have predictable solar systems that probably contain a planet in the Goldilocks zone. That's a lot of possibilities. That's the good news. Not the bad news, the distances are pretty great. And so the grand QSO in the sky is going to take a while. It's going to take some good hardware to do that. And you've got some time delay problems and so on. But we're probably not alone. To think that this only happened once, and that we happen to be in the one place that it happened, you have to be a little bit arrogant to believe that. If you've got some understanding of the physics and astronomy and astrology, not astrology, here we go, astronomy, cosmology, if you've got some understanding of cosmology, you come to a particular point of view. It's not the only point of view. And there are people who differ with that. And I understand that. What else is going on in space these days, Paul? WSQN, KQRIW?
Hebrews, good evening. Question on this subject.
Okay, no recognized, but go ahead. Paul first.
Pick up Mel, because I really didn't have much tonight. Ever since Endeavor got back, they've got that six-person crew on board the International Space Station. Not much. We're waiting on the next mission, and that's, I think, toward the end of the year, another 3-4 months, I think. But you've got only 7 missions left for the shuttles. And I just wanted to mention one thing, though. You've always asked about extending the shuttle program. They plan on running these 7 missions. There's always delays. You know, it always seems like it's a delay here, a delay there, weather, a hydrogen leak. They will run these whole 7 missions, even if it goes beyond 2010. I did hear that recently, Dick. Thank you.
And when the subsequent replacement for the shuttle, when we find out how long that's going to be delayed, I'd like to believe Congress will come up with a sudden pocket of money to extend the space shuttle program to fill up that gap, to be thoroughly dependent on other nations to supply our space launching capability and our refurbishment of the International Space Station and the maintenance of our particular astronauts. From my point of view, that's an uncomfortable position to be in. You don't want to be dependent on other people on such an important thing, from my point of view. Now I have a further question. K2KUI, K2RAW.
NW82CDO, saying hello.
Hello, Andy. A little bit late for you, but glad to hear you. Mel first, and then Andy asked second. Go ahead, Mel.
I'm wondering whether I saw an extra CW was in there. Question. You know, you say the Goldilocks and this so-called futuristic great QSO there in space. Is it possible we'll find a planet? Why can't this planet be at a stage where, dinosaurs are still roaming around, that they didn't get hit by an asteroid, and dinosaurs are still the primary creatures, reptiles are primary creatures? Would we be able to recognize a planet like that? In other words, we're looking for what? And picking up a radio signal or something of intelligence. But isn't there a possibility that there isn't so-called intelligence as we know it, but a life type of, say, like the reptiles? Stick over.
Okay. To partially answer that question, Mel, Kepler is now measuring the constituents of the atmosphere of the planet that's 1,000 light years away going around that particular star. That's just the beginning. This is the first time Kepler's really been turned on. It's making a specific measurement. It's going to make a hell of a lot more measurements. And it may be slated for a 3-year mission, but I guarantee if it doesn't have a failure, it's going to be extended way beyond that. Because it's going to be getting a kind of data that we're going to get hooked on. We're going to say, hey, this is great stuff. Can't live without it. Let's keep doing this. And let's launch some more Keplers and look in some other directions. One of the predictions I've once seen is that if you're standing off a very long distance away from planet Earth and you want to find out if there's life on planet Earth, what's the first thing you would detect? And one of the reports I read, I don't know how accurate it is that methane in our atmosphere given off by the digestive systems of bovine animals. And I'm not kidding. And human beings are also giving off methane. But in other words, the methane gas given off by all of these animals on this planet may be the easiest thing that you can detect from a long distance. And as such, now that we're measuring the atmospheric constituents of these atmospheres of these other planets, we will detect the fact that some kind of biological life is there, whether it be dinosaurs or the advancement of human beings. That's a beautiful speculation. But find the life first. Just find biological life, by our standards, in some other heavenly body will be considered a valuable piece of information. And I'm convinced, it's going to be hard for me to reset the machine right now, I'm convinced that, in fact, there's another way I can come into it. So if I get chopped out, there'll be a little bit of delay until I come in by the other technique. We're slowly being humbled step by step by step that we used to think that the Earth was the center of the universe and everything went around us. Step by step we find out we're not the center of the universe, we're not the center of the solar system, we're not the center of the galaxy, we're not in the center galaxy of the galactic group, and we're not in the center of the universe. We're in the midway position of all of that. It's a good, desirable place to be, but we're not at the leading edge, we're not at the back of the pack, we're in the middle. That leads me to believe of all the life that's out there, technologically speaking, half of it is ahead of us and half of it is behind us. And which half are we going to see first? You and I can speculate about that. I'm convinced that there's a lot of life out there. A lot of it is ahead of us technologically, a lot of it's behind us. Let's just find it first. It's going to upset a number of spiritual people when we discover biological life anywhere else in this universe. Because depending on how you read the books, the good books of various faiths, that's not clear. That's not a prediction, to my understanding. Maybe that's a partial answer to what you're asking there, Mel. K2KUI, K2RAW.
Comment, WS2N.
Paul, next, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Thanks. No, I'm just wondering, up on a planet that may have an atmosphere and all, but doesn't emit any RF signals or whatever, and because they are maybe still back in the prehistoric age or whatever, you know, are we not going to just dismiss it? But I understand from what you're saying that if they have methane in the atmosphere, that we will stop and look closer at that planet and not, you know, just particularly look for. I always thought that the SETI project was really always looking for the emission of some kind of intelligent radio signal of some sort, TV, whatever the heck we've been sending out. But now you say that it would be just anything that would have an atmosphere that would be of interest. Is that correct? That's basically what this project is looking for. Any place where possible life may exist in any form, over.
Okay. In the very beginning, to look for extraterrestrial life. At that time, our technology is such that the longest range communication, the longest range probing that we were capable of doing was by radio. And along came Frank Drake, roughly 1968, I think it was, maybe it was 1958, Frank Drake was working for the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. He had just finished a contract signing to build a 60-foot diameter dish, which at the time was the biggest thing going. And he talked the vendor of that dish to complete the project for this radio telescope 1 month ahead of schedule. And a whole lot of plans were made as to what radio astronomy measurements are going to be made with that dish. He was crafty enough to talk nicely or whatever to that manufacturer of that dish and get it done a month ahead of time. And I think it was 1968. He used that month to scan the heavens for radio signals of intelligence. And he didn't find any. But he made that leap of faith that they could be there, and he looked for it, because in that day, the best thing we had to look for biology was to look for the radio signal. That was the longest range probing technique we had. Oh, we've come a long way since Frank Drake and the Drake equation that made a very pessimistic prediction as to how much life is out there. We found out he was overly conservative. He thought there was only one chance in a million that a star would have planets going around it. He was wrong by 100,000 to one. It's more than 10%. Maybe it's 50%. So of his many steps in his equation, just the very first step was super conservative by, one-tenth of a million to one. And there's a hell of a lot of other portions of the equation that's too conservative. Now you've got something like Kepler, where you don't have to look for the radio signal. You look for something much more basic. Look for the digestive gases coming out of the guts of animals. That's an indication of biological life. It doesn't have to be intelligent life that's transmitting a coherent radio signal with a telescope that's aimed in your direction. It doesn't have to be anywhere near that restrictive. By way of the Doppler shift, you get from the spectral signature from the star, you see the star wobble, and you can detect the presence of planets. We've been doing that since roughly 1997 or 1995, somewhere around that time frame. So we've been finding out the stars that got wobbled because there were big planets in close. And slowly we were finding that process. We were finding smaller and smaller planets. But what Kepler is doing is a hell of a lot more sensitive and a lot more basic to a biological search. That's the best technique today. 10 years from now, there'll be an even more basic technique in which we look for biological life at a greater distance for a larger number of stars and so on. It's just a matter of time until we find biology. It's going to be a slightly longer amount of time before we find intelligent biology that feels like talking to us. That's an opinion. WS2N, K2LAW, you got a call.
Okay, yeah, very good. Get it. We've had a lot of spacecraft that have gone out of the Earth's orbit and look back at Earth to calibrate things. And, you know, they'll look for things like oxygen and carbon dioxide, methane, and that's how they do a lot of calibration now. And that's what they would see. That's what they're looking for. They'd be happy to see carbon dioxide. They'd be happy to see oxygen. You know, they'd have a supplement. You know, there's plants or animals there. methane, definitely, that's been written about. Carl Sagan has talked about methane quite a bit, being one of the gases that they would love to see coming off of a distant planet. The only problem I have with all of this is, you know, with all the millions of different species that we have here on Earth, we're the only ones that are capable of listening or transmitting a signal to even listen. The next closest smartest animal is what, the porpoise. I haven't seen them side of two wires together yet, so, you know, you might have millions of planets that show signs of life, you know, carbon dioxide or especially methane. Carbon dioxide, because, you know, that could be volcanoes or whatever, but they would love to see methane from a job. And the other problem is time. You know, we've been around for 5 billion years. The universe is now, what, 13.7 billion years old. That's what they figured out. I remember 20 years ago, there was a possibility it was 20 billion years old, but they've narrowed that down to 13.7. And we've been around 5 billion years without a sun. And out of those 5 billion years, what life has been on Earth, with the dinosaurs and all, they go back hundreds of millions of years, and the humans have been only walking around, you know, a fraction, a small, tiny fraction of time. Again, a Carl Sagan show showed a whole calendar. And if the whole calendar was, you know, the life of the universe, we were only one teeny tiny dot, split second at the end of December 31st, last day of this calendar. We dropped it. So we're trying to search for a signal that's maybe either probably too far away. If they are out there, you know, maybe in a different galaxy, hopefully not. Out of a couple hundred billion stars that we have here, we're gambling that there's an intelligent life form on one of the stars. I'm sure there's plenty of life out there. I agree with most of the scientists. But intelligent life, I think that's going to be possibly hard to come by, because now you've also got to find it in our time frame. You know, there's many possibilities that there were life forms out there that sent signals, but, you know, for a couple hundred years, and then they decided to blow themselves up, you know, nuclear holocaust or something, and they're not around. So they might have been sending signals 1 billion years ago, or even 1 million years ago. So the odds are definitely against finding some kind of intelligent life. So it's definitely worth a look, and especially for the Kepler, it's definitely worth a look to find some kind of sign of some kind of biological life on any one of the planets. That would, you know, that would point them in the right direction. I think that right here, the WS line.
I hear what you're saying, Paul, and I see why you're saying it. And I think you're being super conservative. You're being another Frank Drake. Without a doubt, this sun is something like 5 billion years old. This Earth is something like 4.5 billion years old. I forget the exact number, but maybe it was close to 1 billion years before single cellular life came onto this planet. And if you look at the fossil record indicates to me quite clearly that life continues to get more and more and more complicated. It's not a very single cellular life with asexual reproduction, and you slowly progress up to very complicated animals with fancy DNA. But that's the end of that process. It's continuing. Homo sapiens have only walked this planet for something like 300,000 years. There's a man-like animal, Australopithecus, and Lucy. Lucy was 3 billion years old. Actually, 3 million years old. But that wasn't exactly a Homo sapien. each other continuously, completely. And by the way, life is so tough. Even if you and I were part of a complete nuclear meltdown of some kind, we would set back this planet by 10,000 years. Compared to the 4.5 billion years of this planet, that's minor. It'll come back. Some of those people will be hiding in a cave and whatever. Life will continue with pretty tenacious stuff.
Repeater, time out.
You can go to the coldest part of Antarctica, dig down in the ice as many feet as you want, and you'll find living items there. It is extremely difficult to find a single cubic centimeter anywhere on planet Earth that does not contain biological life. The only place discovered so far, I think it's the Altacola Desert on top of a mountain in Chile, where it rained the tenth of an inch of water per decade, and the soil there is so dry that they haven't found anything living in that particular soil. That's a very rare place on this planet. Life is everywhere else. It'll survive, no matter what you do to it. And since some of those life forms out there have got a billion years head start on us, and they've progressed through all of this temporary stages we're going through right now, we're fighting each other, and they've survived it. And even if you want to be pessimistic and say only one society in 10 survives it, when you're starting off with 10 to the 16th power of possible societies, and you cut it down by another 10, 100, another 1,000, another million. Still a lot of life out there as I see it. And as I said, the fossil record shows to me it's getting more complicated. The fact that the life that you and I care about, intelligent life, has only been here for a very small fraction of the time of the existence of this planet, doesn't mean any other planet is like that. Some of those guys are going to hit start. Just, we're thinking a little bit too provincial on that one, in my opinion, than Paul. The whole universe is not exactly like us. The whole universe is not necessarily going to go through the dinosaur stage. There's other ways it could have been done. That's an opinion. How about you, Paul? The BS2N, K2LIW?
KT2FYJ, comment.
FYJ, yes, Paul.
I believe me, I hope you're right. And, well, I'm looking for, you need a place to go, you know. So if you can find an Earth-like place, you can set up camp there. And then, you know, this way, if they blow themselves up here, you could continue mankind somewhere else. So I really don't care if they find the signal or not. But looking for a life raft thing.
Again, that's a little bit provincial, Paul. To take you and transport you to any other planet of this solar system would require an amount of resources right now that would take a dedication of almost all of the high technology countries of this planet to transport you and all the life support systems to another nearby planet of this solar system. To transport you and all your life support systems to some other solar system is out of the question. And you're just one guy, one very valuable guy. And there's 5 billion more of them on this planet. What are you going to do with them? So for us to go somewhere else and call it a lifeboat, good sounding science fiction, I doubt it. You better bloom where you planted. You better protect this particular planet. Because the resources required to get off here with current technology, out of sight. That's my opinion. Let's see what Harry's going to say on all this. KT2FYJ. He's going to straighten us out on all this. KT2LIW, you got it, Harry.
Dick, I have to go. WACDL.
To me.
Okay, Andy, why don't you put in a couple of words, because you've got to go. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Hello, Harry. Just want to know, I requested another ham to come on the TechNet and talk about a problem he was having with his sprinkler system on the 80-meter band. Did he come on and talk to you about it? Because I told him to come on.
He sure did. I covered his subject for a half hour, and I think he went away happy. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, because we had a discussion about it, and it turns out he's not using a Bowen, which I recommended, because the feed point is from his dipole is rather close to a non-shielded control box. It's like he said it's a plastic box in his laundry room, which is being affected. All right, I'm happy that he came on. Just told me you would give him some more advice. I got to go. I'll speak to you in a week, okay?
Roger, Roger. Looking forward to that. I guess we discussed all of those details. We think he got a medium good answer. He went away happy. We gave him a couple of homework assignments. He's going to be coming back. Hey, Harry. One of those long delayed echoes really going to contain the intelligent life that we want to talk to. The great big keystone in the sky. KC2FYJ. K2RAW.
All right, I'll clear. WHCDO. Harry, go ahead. Thanks.
Good evening, Andy. Have a pleasant night. Dick, all I was going to do was point out that one of the, I guess you could call it, fallacies of what's being done in this search for biological life is the assumption that it's going to be carbon-based. There's a great deal of evidence to suggest that it's possible for life to be to develop that is not carbon-based, but, for example, silicon-based. And what that biology would look like and what it would produce is a vast open question. So it's quite possible that there's biological life out there that we might not even recognize with our current investigative techniques. And it's possible that it could be intelligent life. Furthermore, given that we've only been around for the blink of an eye of the past 5 billion years in a universe that's been in existence for 13 billion, it's quite conceivable to me that there is a vastly greater intelligent life form that has developed, say, 8 billion years ago, and has managed to evolve to a point that we couldn't recognize it if it was sitting in front of our nose. So, it seems to me that we need to be very, very careful in making pronouncements about what is out there and what may be out there, because it is more than likely that the reality is going to be far stranger than anything that we can imagine. Just my opinion. KC2FYJ, back to net.
I hear what you're saying, Harry. But there's a couple of factors making it less likely what you're saying. Not impossible, less likely. Yes, you can make some pretty complicated things out of silicon. As you study the carbon atom, you'll rapidly come to the conclusion that, wow, is it adaptable. My goodness, there are a zillion ways it will come together and make some beautiful bonds that have just the right bonding strength that you can make and break those bonds when you want to for biological items. Carbon is an extremely adaptable element. Silicon, although we've done a lot with silicon when it comes to things like transistors and integrated circuits, for it to happen, and we've had to put forth heroic efforts to make the silicon pure enough, to put it with just the right temperatures, just the right doping materials and whatever, to make all of these fancy electronic circuits. We've had to use heroic efforts to do that. Silicon in the natural form in Mother Nature does not do that. Carbon does. I don't know the exact numbers, but when it comes to making complicated compounds and organisms, if someone did an objective study and told me that carbon is more likely to naturally, by Mother Nature, make the desirable compounds compared to silicon, the carbon has 100,000 times more likelihood of doing it, I would believe them. I'm not sure what the number is. So carbon is a much more desirable material for naturally forming things that can eventually result in life. That's a strongly felt opinion. The second idea, let me drop, is that you'd like to believe that in the 13.7 billion years since the Big Bang, that somebody 8 billion years started forming life. To the problem. Our sun is a third generation sun. Right after the Big Bang, you had almost nothing but hydrogen, came together in great big sun solar systems, so to speak, that went through a life cycle of slowly climbing portions of the periodic table and then going supernova, scattering their materials into space, which reformed. So you got slightly more complicated compounds from the early supernovas of the early stars, which got reformed into a secondary star, which made slightly more complicated compounds. They went supernova, scattered their slightly more complicated materials, and finally you came up with a sun like ours and a planetary system around it that contains a lot more stuff than just hydrogen and helium. You need a hell of a lot of other elements to really have the raw ingredient, like carbon. So it took three steps for our sun to get where it is. You don't do that in a couple of billion years. It took time. So when you recognize the mechanism by which our sun and these particular planets made out of this kind of stuff formed, that took time. And I still think carbon is the most likely. Not the only, but way ahead of the game of all the alternatives that you and I know about today. What's your opinion? KC2FYJ, K2LIW.
Well, I wasn't saying silicone is it. I was just using it as a for instance. And I grant you, in our environment, that the statements that you made are true. But consider an alternate environment where, for whatever reason, it's a much more prevalent compound or element than it is here. Consider an environment where temperature and pressure differentials are substantially different than they are here. All of those things can cause changes or alternatives to the way things developed here. I'm not saying it's so. I'm saying it's conceivable. And I'm saying that given the vast, vast number of planetary systems that are out there, that, well, frankly, anything's possible from my perspective. I'm willing to keep my my mind wide open to any and all possibilities, because to do otherwise, in my opinion, is to be egocentric about it, terracentric about it, if you will. And I'm just concerned that that's going to cause sort of a local blindness to alternative possibilities, just because we're looking for us out there, and we may not be out there. It may be something very, very different. Even if it is carbon-based, it could be very, very different. Again, just my opinion, KC2FYJ, back to Ned.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Harry. Lots and lots of possibilities of different ways of doing it. And we're far from the only way. But still, if you're looking for elements, you go to the place where it's likely there to be elements. You choose whatever you think is the most likely, you go to the place that's got the right raw ingredients for that to be likely in that place. Right now, you and I think we are most interested in hydrocarbon life. We think we're a little bit less interested in silicon life, and I think that silicon life is quite a bit less likely. And even if you accept the fact that silicon life is a possibility that you don't want to deny, what would you do different in the search? In the process of doing something like Kepler is doing right now, where we're not only measuring where are the stars that have planets, which stars are occulting those planets, and we're measuring the atmospheric constituent of those planets. We're not being restricted that we're only looking for certain elements and we're going to throw away the information on all the others. If we find a number of planets going around a number of those stars with the Kepler spacecraft that has a whole lot of silicon in the atmosphere instead of a whole lot of hydrocarbons, guarantee nobody's going to deny that and look for particular signatures that represent an intelligence. So, the equipment is continuously improving. The techniques and sensitivity and spacecraft are continuously improving. The communication with them is improving. It's getting better. It's just a matter of time before we find it. And you're worried that we're being overly restrictive. I understand you worry. But our methods of search are continuously expanding. The bandwidth over which we're looking, so to speak, and the possibility is continuously expanding. So I think by an almost automatic process, what you're concerned about, to some degree, I think is being handled. Again, that's an opinion. Back to you, Harry, K2LIW.
You could be right, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that as a possibility. And the bottom line is, since you and I don't have any control over it anyway, we just have to play a wait-and-see game.
We've got a little bit of control. You and I can get on the air, express opinions back and forth. People listen to those opinions. If enough people agree with us, they speak to their senators and congressmen. They write letters to the president. They write letters to NASA. And NASA is funded by your and my tax money. We don't have direct say in what's going on. Indirectly, we've got a say. If you and I came up with an extremely good opinion that hasn't been considered until now, and we properly propagate that opinion, write letters, write articles, do whatever, we can get some action. Not easy. Nothing worth doing is easy. But it's going to happen. I think we live in a very exciting time. And you can talk about the good old days if you want to. 10 years from now, you guys, all of us, will be talking about the good old days of 2009. As long as we live long enough, you wait and see. Now, Mel and I will talk about the good old days of our college years back in 1960-something. And it was fun then. By our current standards, what we did and what we were excited with then, today is kind of primitive. Neil Armstrong, just for instance, landed on the moon with the best computer they could create that has barely the capability that you got in the, on your cell phone in your pocket today. You could have done a much better job with a computer like the one that's in your pocket. We've come a long way. And I'm awful glad that of all the chances he took, it came out successful. He came awful close to dying by my standards as I learned more and more of the details of what he did. I've had personal conversations with him, not on that subject, unfortunately. He was the chairman of the board of a company that I worked for. Hey, with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW and the TechNet. What's the mail been like this week, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Possibility that somebody wants to get in here via the internet, maybe Kent wants to say some words, because I'm sure this subject is very dear to his heart. Over.
Okay, we're going to give a nice long delay. Anyone else on planet Earth that's listening to this jazz, if you're foolish enough, give us your call letters right now. KQLIW. As I see it, the silence is deafening, Mel. If we were really naive, we'd say it's just you and me. Tell me about your mailbag. I'm going to take a quick look at my email just in case somebody tries to contact me during the day. Occasionally that happens. You got to know.
Roger. I'm just looking through some things here and see, you know, what would be of really interest to people and stuff that we can discuss on the air. A lot of things here I'm just going to, as they say, pass up. Here's a question. I've seen this question a number of times. Years ago, I know they had amplifiers that today maybe still can be salvaged. I picked up a AM rig, and it's an AM amplifier. I have the whole works for the separate modulator, and looks like it supposedly was most likely rated around a kilowatt. How much work would be involved to convert this over to be used on single sidebands as a linear amplifier? You know, I've seen this question a number of times. Maybe we can touch upon what constituted a kilowatt amplifier back in so-called our days, Dick, and what is the chances or what is the difference in today's amplifiers over.
Okay, many of the kilowatt amplifiers of, I'm going to figure here, 1960, 1970, consisted of 813, HF kilowatt amplifiers, consisted of things like 813 tubes, a pair of them running push bolts, a 500 watt audio output transformer, which did the high level amplitude modulation of the plate voltage, and maybe that was fed with a pair of 813s. So, you ran a pair of 813s push-pull to make 500 watts of audio. You had a pair of 813s in the RF final amplifier stage. And as you band switched the input grid circuit and the output plate circuits, you went from 80 to 10 meters with a Pi network. And so this amplifier that had 1,500 watts of output of power supply at numbers like 3,000 volts to run those tubes. She got a great big power transformer generating the 1,500 watts of B-plus at around 3,000 volts. This great big heavy 500-watt transformer, those tubes, the tank circuit, and whatever. All together, that amplifier, that kilowatt amplifier with AM modulation, Collins made one like it. I don't know the exact number, but if someone told me it weighed 400 pounds total, I'd believe it. It probably took up a 19-inch rack, probably a foot and a half or 2 feet high at least. Could you use that today? In a way, yes. There are guys who just love the sound of high-level amplitude modulation with broad bandwidth audio, and they get on the 80-meter band and talk to each other. There's a subculture that does that and enjoys that. But if you compare the size, weight, portability, dollars, maintainability, whatever, of a modern-day single sideband transmitter, you can't compare the DX capability of sideband compared to AM, you'll rapidly come to the conclusion you get a lot more range with a lot less dollars, a lot higher efficiency, and a much smaller package with a lot less weight with a modern-day single sub repeater. Time out. With a modern-day single sideband transmitter, if you want to transmit audio, there's all kinds of digital techniques that can transmit data for you. And if you want to get really far-range, weak signal stuff, the K1JT technique, WSJT, weak signal Joe Taylor technique, which is a quasi-digital computer-generated set of four tones, which can dig 28 dB into the noise, and therefore 150 watts into one very good Yagi on the chimney of the house on 2 meters can do moon bounce. Modern-day equipment, just like the modern-day computer, that computer in your pocket called cell phone, with or without text messaging capability and camera and global positioning satellite capability and so on, that computing capability in that small package for that reasonable price of a few $100 is way ahead of the $100 million thing called computer that Neil Armstrong used. So is there a great advantage of going back in time if you like nostalgia, if you like classic pieces of equipment, and if you want to join that subculture of people with high fidelity, high power AM modulation on 80 meters? Yes, there's some value. I guess you have to decide what you want to do. Do you want to tinker with antennas? Do you want to tinker with VX? Do you want to tinker with VHF, UHF, exotic modulation techniques, microwave, fancy dishes? With 26, 27 different kinds of ham radio. If you're bored with the one you've tried, or the two or three you've tried, at least find out what the others are doing, find out who's doing it, and decide whether or not you want to join them. So, there are people who love collecting Collins equipment, classic Cadillac-type Collins equipment, 1960 vintage, and restoring them. And they get great pleasure out of that. Is it capability in its technology to do things today that we really value? Not so much. But they are beautiful pieces of equipment that the people 20, 30 years ago would have given their eye teeth to own if they could have afforded it. So, I didn't give you an answer.
Repeater, time out.
Whoever the writer was of your question, Mel, I didn't give him an answer, but at least I gave him a couple of the raw ingredients by which he can derive the answer for himself, because this is a personal question. What do you value? What gives you pleasure? And there are people who derive great pleasure out of restoring and owning classic pieces of electronics. Whether or not they use it today, in some cases, is academic. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Now the question is basically, inherited, whether it be a homebrew or one of the commercial rigs that ran kilowatt back in those days on AM, and now he'd like to use the rig as a linear amplifier and put things sideband, and what's involved in converting it over. and it's not as difficult as it seems. First of all, let's touch upon it. They did say that the old AM kilowatt rigs such as Collins made, I had a Johnson, what was known as the kilowatt desktop rig that was quite a piece of equipment. There was a desk and a kilowatt, AM kilowatt rig sitting on the side, and you put your receiver, exciter, your transmitter on top there, and looked very good, but it was a pain in, you know what, it seemed like it needed repairs every time you used it for 1 hour, something was wrong, you spent another hour repairing it, but that's beside the point. But there was a number of them on the market and that show up now, and let's talk about what they were. Basically, they were mostly all what was known as Class C amplifiers. So let's talk about maybe what is a Class C amplifier first, Dick, over.
Okay. Once you've got a tube that's got a high power capability, it tolerates high voltage and high current, it's got a lot of watts dissipation of its plate, I think an 813 can dissipate something like 250 watts per anode.